series she was on stage with, Zoe Whittle. It was fantastic. I was there. I want to encourage everyone to get a copy of this book. I really enjoyed reading it, and it kind of blew my mind. So go to Orr Books, www.orrbooks.com. You can order it from there. You can get in a version of an ebook, or you can buy a hard copy. You could also, if you're in Toronto, you can go to Type Books. They will have it there. Type Books is an independent bookstore. There's one on Queen Street West, 883 Queen Street West, and there's another one, 427 Spadina Road. And also just check out Eileen's website. Check out the work that she's done. Get to know it. Her website is eileenmiles.com. And there's two other websites I want to tell you about, which is kind of funny. The reading that I went to on Tuesday that featured Eileen Miles and Zoe Whittle is part of This Is Not a Reading series. They host all sorts of different literary events that are really awesome. You can visit www.tinars, TINARS, it's the acronym for This Is Not a Reading Series.ca, and keep up to date on different things that are happening that are really exciting. And also check out my blog, These Things That People Make, blogspot.com. It's been a really great show. Thank you so much for listening. And next week, tune in, because I'm going to be interviewing my friend Katie about her zine White Elephant. It's about yard sales. And I hope everyone has a fantastic week.
The C.J. Mountfort Centre is a resource centre for people of colour and Aboriginal peoples at the University of Guelph. This is where we all unite. The Mountfort Centre, located in McKinnon Room 54 and 55, provides a microwave, two computers and a fridge, among other resources. The centre is a place to study, sleep or relax. It's a place for great conversation. If you want to vent, share experience, good or bad, this is the place for you. You meet great people, and it's just an overall awesome environment. Don't hesitate to drop in anytime before 10 p.m., and you're sure to meet a smiling face. For more information, call us at 519-824-4120, extension 56911, or visit us at www.uoguelph.ca/Mountfort, or join our Facebook group.
I'm your host, Sheila O'Reilly, and I'd like to invite you to a dog's breakfast, Saturday mornings from 10 to 11. We'll be celebrating music from all corners of the globe, with a special focus on music inspired by elsewhere, but cooked up by our many voices here in Canada. Please join me for a dog's breakfast here on CFRU 93.3 FM on Saturday mornings from 10 to 11.
This year has seen the culmination of a four-year struggle against the Olympics being held on unceded Indigenous land.
Indigenous sovereignty was a large theme of protest against the G20, and communities like the Anishinaabeg of Grassy Narrows and Algonquins of Barrier Lake have put up blockades to assert sovereignty with local issues.
This year is the 20th anniversary of the Yoka Crisis, and Indigenous communities continue to resist land theft today.
On Friday, October 22nd, the 6th annual Anti-Colonial Thanksgiving Dinner Potluck will bring out community members to share a large meal, followed by speakers from Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg Nations.
The dinner and speakers will help build connections between settler communities and the original peoples. This event is also a celebration of autumn and an opportunity to renew our commitment to Indigenous sovereignty.
Come out to the Guelph Youth Music Center, 75 Cardigan Street, on October 22nd at 6 p.m. to share in the spirit of resistance. Bring a food dish to share. The GYMC is an accessible space, and this event is free. Children are also welcome.
Search us out online if you'd like to volunteer before or during the event.
Come out to the Guelph Youth Music Center at 75 Cardigan Street in downtown Guelph on Friday, October 22nd at 6 p.m.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 6, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the Supreme Court hears arguments in a First Amendment case that features anti-gay protests at military funerals. The first civilian trial of a former Guantanamo detainee begins in New York. And Congress calls for an investigation into mortgage fraud after more banks reveal improper review of thousands of foreclosures. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. It's been only 3 days since an environmental catastrophe in Hungary killed four and injured more than 120 people. The holding wall of a reservoir at an aluminum plant collapsed, releasing massive amounts of toxic industrial waste into seven villages in the western part of the country. FSRN's Amy Miller has this update.
Gábor Fergetsky with the World Wildlife Foundation Hungary is at the village of Kalantar near the Markel River. He says all fish stock have already been destroyed and the death toll for other wildlife will be high as well. Rescue missions are underway.
So rescue teams are working hard and we can see soldiers coming up and down, helping people, washing cars, washing everything. And the rescue teams are also working and there's a lot of help coming and a lot of donations were given in the forms of rubber boots and food. Still, we can hear that some people don't want to move back into their homes, so that's going to be a long-term problem.
While the immediate cleanup near the village is of great concern, many in the region are extremely apprehensive about the sludge entering the Danube River, estimated to happen within 5 days. In the Danube, the toxic material would flow through five more countries before eventually ending up in the Black Sea. Amy Miller, FSRN.
In an effort to smooth over relations and convince Pakistani officials to reopen the Torkum border crossing, today U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson apologized for an incident last week where NATO helicopter fire killed two Pakistani border guards. She referred to the shooting as a terrible accident. In other Pakistan news, NATO forces have lost another convoy of fuel tankers after armed militants attacked and burned the trucks. Officials say nearly two dozen trucks were burned. Roadside bombs detonated last night in the Afghan city of Kandahar killed 9 people, including 5 children, according to the AP. The bombs targeted police vehicles. In a statement today, President Hamid Karzai said the militants were deliberately targeting children. This comes as Taliban representatives are meeting with the Afghan government in high-level talks. Obama Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said this morning the U.S. supports such talks, but says it is not involved in the negotiations. The United Nations wrapped up a donor conference yesterday, securing $11.7 billion in international support to fight malaria, tuberculosis, and AIDS. Although this is an increase of nearly $2 billion over the 2008 to 2010 pledge to the Global Fund, it's still far short of the $17 billion goal Secretary General Ban Ki-moon pushed.
The demand for funding will outstrip even the important commitments made today. That means we must continue to mobilize more resources, more will, more quickly. We must seek more innovation in funding policy and delivery. And we must continue to expand the coalition of partners contributing to these extraordinary efforts.
Secretary Ban said the UN's goal is to eliminate deaths caused by malaria by 2015. This morning in Puerto Rico, the FBI arrested 133 police officers, corrections officials, civilians, and National Guard and Army personnel accused of corruption. The FBI says this is the culmination of a 2-year investigation connected to drug and arms trafficking. Rosa Emilia Rodriguez Velez is the U.S. attorney for the District of Puerto Rico.
We are faced with the disconcerting reality that drug trafficking has invaded the sanctity of our state and municipal police departments. Badges were sold and honor was compromised for drug money many times during this investigation. But today is also a day of hope in the fight against drug trafficking and the violence it generates in Puerto Rico.
This is the largest police corruption case in FBI history. And finally, in other FBI news, anti-war activists in Chicago and Minneapolis say they will not appear before a grand jury as ordered by authorities after their homes were raided by FBI agents 2 weeks ago. A video from The Uptake shows dozens of Minneapolis protesters rallying yesterday in solidarity with the accused.
We've done nothing wrong. We're organizing against the wars that the United States is waging, and we're in solidarity with people who are oppressed in other countries. That's a good thing, not a bad thing, and hence no one's going to a grand jury to talk about their friends and neighbors.
The homes of 14 activists were raided as part of a material support or terrorism funding investigation. Many of the activists have pleaded the fifth. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a landmark First Amendment case, whether anti-gay protesters have a right to picket military funerals with hateful signs. In this emotional and highly charged case, the Supreme Court must decide if any additional limits should be placed on free speech. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Westboro Baptist Church was founded by Fred Phelps. It's a small but vocal group made up mostly of Phelps's family members. They've dedicated their lives to gay bashing. Since the early 90s, they've protested daily in Kansas and have traveled across the country holding signs that read, "God hates fags" and "God hates America." In 2006, they traveled to Maryland and stood outside the funeral of Albert Snyder's son, Matthew. He was not gay, but was killed in Iraq. They then posted video of their protests, which they call epic.
Our son, a hero, dead, only to be compounded by the family being targeted and subject to personal attacks, venomous hate, and injustice at Matt's funeral.
Outside the Supreme Court Wednesday, Fred Phelps Jr. was one of a dozen church members picketing. His sign read, "Fags doom nations," and "God is your enemy." He explains why he and his family protested Matt Snyder's and other military funerals.
Well, that's where everybody is. That's where all the media is. That's where all the military is. That's where all the civilians are. And they all have a message. And they're using those military funerals to convey their message. And so we said, hey, the First Amendment allows our citizens to do that, so we'll go there and convey our message. We thought that was pretty reasonable, being as how the First Amendment allows for that, and that's what this country brags about. And so that's what we did, and all hell broke loose.
Albert Snyder sued the church for $5 million for intentional infliction of emotional distress. Snyder says he is haunted by the website and the television images of his son's funeral. He says the funeral was a private event and should be protected as such.
There is a civilized way to express an opinion in America, but it does not involve intentionally inflicting emotional distress on others, intentionally harming a private citizen at a private funeral. It's not the constitutional right.
The Phelps clan disagree. They say Snyder's funeral was a public event because the local newspaper published an obituary and a statement was made to the press. Margie Phelps argued the case. She's also a member of the family, a church member, and a protester.
When you have, note to all, when you have a private funeral, we will not be there. When you have a public funeral and you broadcast to the nation that dead soldier is a hero and that God is blessing America, we will be there and tell you God is cursing America. It is a curse for your young men and women to be coming home in body bags. And if you want that to stop, stop sinning.
The Supreme Court appeared to be skeptical of limiting free speech, but they also questioned Phelps's motives. Justices asked if they protested funerals just for publicity. The attorney for Albert Snyder, Sean Summers, says the Phelps' hateful actions were intentional and directed at Snyder personally.
It's the personal targeted nature of the speech. For example, if the Phelps said, we like the war, we don't like the war, we like taxes, we don't like taxes, obviously that's not actionable. When you specifically identify the Snyder family by name, not innuendo, by name, that is targeted harassment. And that, by, in our judgment, by no stretch of the imagination, is protected speech.
The case has drawn a broad array of interest. Siding with the military family are 42 members of the U.S. Senate and the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Siding with the protesters are the American Civil Liberties Union and other free speech groups. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
On Tuesday, President Obama signed an executive order to create the federal task force that will oversee long-term recovery in the Gulf of Mexico. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson will head up the transition from the response to the BP oil disaster to long-term restoration. The task force will focus on public health issues, economic recovery, and environmental damage. Yesterday, Jackson visited New Orleans, where she met with local environmental leaders. She said the restoration needs to come from the Gulf to Washington and not be imposed by the federal government from D.C. She called on people who, quote, know these areas best to participate. Mary Lee Orr is the executive director of the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. She told FSRN that she welcomes the possibility to be more involved, but that during the first stage of the disaster response, many local groups were shut out.
I think that we can play a very important role, and I think it's been very frustrating. I'm happy to hear Administrator Jackson say that, because when this spill started, part of the Incident Command Handbook is that NGOs are supposed to be an important and integral part of recovery, and it was next to impossible to get into the Incident Command Center or the Unified Command Center to share our knowledge of saying, you know, be careful, there's an oyster bed here, or, you know, in other words, help be a helpful guiding force. Very, very difficult, if not impossible. I don't think anyone of us who tried, and that's all along the Gulf, were really successful on that. So I'm hopeful, but then again, you know, implementation and follow-through is everything.
Orr's group has overseen testing of sediment and seafood. She said they've found high levels of petroleum hydrocarbons and that more rigorous testing is needed. This week, NOAA opened nearly 3,000 more square miles of waters off eastern Louisiana to commercial and recreational fishing. Orr also said that ongoing toll of physical and mental health on residents should be a key part of long-term recovery.
We've had some suicides, people on suicide watch. About a week and a half ago, a woman called and said that she was working with a fisherman who felt suicidal because he felt like he was never going to be able to get through this paperwork. He was not, his education level wasn't as high as he would have liked, and he found it really overwhelming, the process, and was becoming suicidal. So that is something else. We need to make sure that our families are whole as well as the Gulf, or we can't recover.
Also, the federal joint investigation looking into the explosion of BP's Deepwater Horizon rig continues in Metairie, Louisiana. On Tuesday, an employee charged with safety on the Macondo rig told the committee that she did not immediately sound the alarms on the rig after seeing warning lights. According to the Times-Picayune, the worker testified she hesitated because she had never been trained to deal with such a barrage of multiple warnings, and she said she knew of no protocols for activating the emergency shutdown. The hearings continue the rest of the week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling for a federal investigation into possible criminal foreclosure practices. Increasing questions about the validity of documents have caused lenders and states to issue a freeze on foreclosures. One senator is calling for a national moratorium. While the move would keep people in homes, its permanent effects are unclear. Michael Lawson has more.
In a letter addressed to Attorney General Eric Holder, Pelosi and 30 California lawmakers allege that systemic problems exist in the way financial institutions have dealt with foreclosures. Banks, including Ally Financial, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase, have suspended foreclosures in 23 states after admitting to robo-signing thousands of affidavits without any review. Attorneys general in a growing list of states from Connecticut to California are calling for moratoriums to sort through potential improper practices. Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey on Tuesday called for a nationwide moratorium. but some are critical that a moratorium, while immediately beneficial to homeowners in the short term, only delays the inevitable and could do more damage. David Abramowitz is a senior fellow with the Center for American Progress.
For a moratorium that's focused on clearing up whether the documents have been signed correctly and giving a breather just leave things in an uncertain state, because when that moratorium is over, most of those foreclosures will go ahead.
Even without the homeowners facing an imminent foreclosure, a debt overhang of the amount owed versus the current value of homes continues to hamper housing recovery. Abramowitz says lenders have little incentive to actually help homeowners refinance. The Obama administration's Homeowner Affordable Modification Program offers applicants trial modifications but has been criticized for the low number of mortgages converted to permanent ones. While rates of success vary wildly depending on the analysis, an independent review of Treasury data by Barclays Capital found some 50 to 70% of homeowners were back in the delinquent column within 12 months. In a letter to the Justice Department, Pelosi acknowledges that the health of the housing market is essential to the United States' economic recovery. Some mortgage lenders have said the sheer number of foreclosures has hampered clarity in the foreclosure process. Alex Pollack is a resident fellow with the American Enterprise Institute who says the idea of loosening regulations during real estate booms encourages exaggerated enthusiasm and thus a bubble. Despite the structural problems, he says the bank's practices ignore fundamentals.
Well, my guess is if you investigate them, you'll find that in the times of the boom and the enthusiasm and the belief that nothing can go wrong, which is all part of a bubble, that people got sloppy in terms of their documentation. And it's a fundamental discipline of being in the money lending business that you're not supposed to do that. You have to keep all the T's crossed and the I's dotted.
The Justice Department has yet to respond to the request. Despite being under increasing pressure from attorneys general to suspend foreclosures, lenders in states where foreclosures do not require judicial review still continue the process. Meanwhile, in their letter, Pelosi and lawmakers say it's time for the banks to be held accountable. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
This is Zach Badorf in Vancouver, Canada. For 10 years, FSRN has brought the world to your ears, from Argentina to Alaska. From Japan to Johannesburg, FSRN's reporters have brought you in-depth, on-the-ground stories from every continent except Antarctica. Help FSRN celebrate our amazing decade. Go to fsrn.org to find out how.
Today, the first civilian trial for a Guantanamo detainee began in a New York federal court. Ahmed Gailani is charged with assisting al-Qaeda in the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. The case is a critical test for the Obama administration's plan to try terrorism suspects in the civilian judicial system. For more, we're joined by Daphne Evviatar. She's a senior associate with the Law and Security Program at Human Rights First and has been following the case. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Gailani is from Tanzania. He was captured in Pakistan in 2004, spent time in a CIA black site, then transferred to Guantanamo in 2006. When did he make the move to a civilian federal court?
That happened just last year. The Obama administration decided to transfer him to a federal court for trial, and he's the first Guantanamo or former Guantanamo detainee to be tried in the United States.
In the last week, questions have emerged over a witness that the government is putting forward, Hussein Abebe. What is the defense challenging, or why is the defense challenging this?
Well, it's a good question, and this is one of the problems that you have with these cases that came from Guantanamo, where someone was detained initially during the Bush administration's during the policies that they were instituting what they called enhanced interrogation techniques, some of which really constituted torture. So the claim is that Gailani was subjected to these techniques and that he was tortured in CIA custody. That's what he claims. And that it was during the interrogation by the CIA that he named this particular individual, Hussein, who the government now wants to call as a witness. So the claim by the defense is that this witness was really learned about through the torture of this detainee, and therefore his testimony is not admissible in court. The judge hasn't decided that question yet, but that will be a very important question.
Is there any other evidence that was taken during that time of torture, alleged torture or enhanced interrogation techniques that is a question of admissibility in this case?
No, it's very interesting, actually. The government has decided not to try to admit any of the statements that Galani made while in custody. And apparently, since the government isn't exactly contesting, I mean, there hasn't been a finding that he was tortured, but they're not really contesting it either. So it seems that the government is trying to keep this prosecution as clean as it can, in the sense of don't introduce evidence where there could be a problem, where it could be tainted by Galani's treatment in custody. And so the vast majority of the evidence was not obtained then. I think this is the one witness where that issue comes up.
This is the first civilian trial for a former Guantanamo detainee. You have been attending the pretrial, the jury selection process. What has the atmosphere been like in the courtroom?
You know, very calm. It's interesting because about a year ago, you might remember that there was a discussion about the Obama administration said that they wanted to try plotters of the September 11th attacks here in New York in civilian trial, and people protested, and critics of the administration were very angry about it and said that we would need all sorts of heightened security here in New York City. And in fact, if you go to the trial of Mr. Galani, there is almost no heightened security. I mean, there aren't big crowds. There isn't a lot of commotion. There aren't any protests. Most people, we actually, at Human Rights First, we spoke to some people on the street to find out what people knew about the case going on, and most people didn't even know it was going on. So it actually has not caused any of the disruption in New York that many people had anticipated that trying Guantanamo detainees here would cause.
Well, this is the first case in that process of bringing Guantanamo detainees into the civilian justice system. How does this case influence future trials of suspects like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who would presumably have a much higher profile?
Right. It influences in the sense that I think the judge's rulings are being looked at very closely to see how would a federal civilian court handle the problems created by imprisonment at Guantanamo or imprisonment of these detainees in CIA black sites overseas. So far, you saw that the judge refused to dismiss the case either over the speedy trial question or over the allegations of torture. I think the issue of whether he allows this particular witness at issue to testify will be important. I think also just whether the trial proceeds smoothly, whether there's disruptions or security concerns, will be watched very closely. And if the trial proceeds as planned and moves forward smoothly and appears to be done fairly, I think that will bode well for bringing more Guantanamo detainees to New York for trial.
Daphne Evyatar is a senior associate with the Law and Security Program at Human Rights First, and she joined us to talk about the case of Ahmed Gailani. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The ongoing debate over education reform has spilled onto the big screen with the national debut of a film called Waiting for Superman. The critically acclaimed documentary was made by Davis Guggenheim, director of An Inconvenient Truth. It contends that public education can be fixed by expanding charter schools and removing bad teachers. But opponents of these policies say the film represents just the latest push to privatize public education. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr reports.
Waiting for Superman features key figures in the fight to expand publicly funded but privately run charters, including D.C. Public Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, billionaire Bill Gates, and CEO of Harlem Children's Zone, Jeffrey Canada.
You wake up every morning and you know that kids are getting a really crappy education right now.
So you think that most of the kids here are getting a crappy education right now?
Oh, I don't think they are. I know they are.
It takes a lot of outrage and a lot of good examples to say, yes, we can do this.
When you see a great teacher, you are seeing a work of art.
The film debuts nationwide as school districts have begun allocating millions awarded in the Obama administration's Race to the Top competition.